It's hard to believe that we have been having in-depth weekly conversations about movies since 2011.
So many great conversations over the years about so many great movies. All that said, producing this show week after week requires a ton of work behind the scenes.
Becoming a Next Reel member gives you access to all sorts of additional and exclusive content. Plus, you're helping us keep the lights on. Just head to thenextreel.com/membership, where you can learn more about becoming a member, which costs a measly $5 a month, practically the same as one fancy coffee drink. And you get so much more.
Every month, we record a bonus episode exclusively for members. Those episodes cover movies from whatever series we're covering at the moment, or add to previous series.
Some movies we've covered that only members get to hear us discuss include The Blues Brothers,
The Russia House,
Naked Lunch,
Independence Day,
The Hot Rock,
and Relic, the better one. Plus, members get to vote on what we're going to discuss for those episodes.
We also record additional pre- and post-show content in regular episodes that only members get to hear.
Like conversations about similarly themed movies.
And answering listener questions from our live member chat.
Speaking of our live member chat, we record almost all of our episodes in Discord, where members can chat right along with us live.
Members get access to other members-only channels in our Discord community as well. On top of all that, members get all episodes a full week earlier than everyone else in a private Next Reel feed just for them that includes all the shows in the Next Reel family. The Next Reel, The Film Board,
Movies We Like, Sitting in the Dark, and more new projects on the way.
To top it all off, members don't have to listen to ads. We've already eliminated those annoying, dynamically inserted ads that, let's face it, we all hate it.
We are listening to you.
We love podcasting for a living, and those ads help to pay the bills. Now, we're counting on you, dear listener.
We promise. We aren't going back to those terrible, dynamically inserted ads that don't relate to us at all. All we ask is that you consider supporting the Next Reel family of podcasts with a membership.
Again, it's $5 per month or $55 per year. Just head to thenextreel.com/membership.
thenextreel.com/membership. Get your access to early, ad-free episodes with bonus content, member bonus episodes, and access to member channels and live streams in Discord by signing up today. I'm Pete Wright.
And I'm Andy Nelson.
Welcome to The Next Reel. When the movie ends,
our conversation begins.
The deep end is over. Bobo, she's a mother, not a moron.
Mr. Reese, I want you to stay away from my son.
I thought I was your little secret.
There are some secrets.
He's my friend, that's all.
That can never be told.
Well, he may not be the friend you think he is.
He's dead. He was killed, and now he was here.
There are some mysteries.
You're saying someone murdered him.
Do you think the police will want to speak with you?
That should never be solved.
I came to talk about Darby Reese and your son.
What exactly is it you want?
And there are some choices.
Your son's been spending a lot of time with Mr. Reese. Special time.
That come with a price.
$50,000 by tomorrow, or there'll be a copy with the Tahoe police.
Where do you expect me to get $50,000 in 24 hours?
That's the position you're in.
Tilda Swinton's performance is a thing of beauty.
I just want to know what happened.
Do we have to talk about this now? Just let it go.
A stunningly tight and evocative thriller.
I want that money.
It is not the kind of thing that everyone can just go out and get.
Mesmerizing, elegantly shot, and exquisitely made.
I don't think you're really trying.
How would you be really trying to find this $50,000 you've come here to steal from me?
Tilda Swinton creates a masterful performance.
I'm not sure you understand the situation.
Maybe I should take a page from your book. Maybe I should blackmail someone.
And Goran Vishnik gives a remarkable performance.
Just keep your family away.
Once she looks beneath the surface.
What's going on?
It's not what you think.
How do you know what I think?
She doesn't know where it will lead.
I asked you to handle this. You did not.
Who it will touch.
If I could make him go away, I would.
Why are you doing this?
Or how deep it will go.
Margaret, stop!
I'm sorry for all of this.
We have no choice now.
Fox Searchlight Pictures presents...
I can put an end to this, to all of this.
Whatever happened that night is over. Put all this behind you as if it never happened.
The Deep End.
It's for you.
We're talking about The Deep End, Andy. Oh, my goodness. Now, I can't remember. Had you seen The Deep End?
No, I had not seen this before. I feel like I had heard of it when it came out. One of those like indie Fox Searchlight limited releases. You know, it had some awards buzz, things like that. But I didn't end up seeing it. Didn't catch it.
Okay. This was the first time for me, too. And why are we talking about it? What was this nominated for?
We are here talking about Best Cinematography for the 2002 Film Independent Spirit Awards. This film was one of the five nominees. The cinematography is, it was called out a number of times for a number of awards.
Okay. I'll give it beautiful cinematography.
Uh-oh.
Well, I mean...
The way that you say that.
No, I just found this movie, it's one of those movies where it is not sold, I don't think, well enough, the motivations behind these characters. And so I struggled with it. I struggled with the movie. It just felt kind of clumsy and long-winded. And they kept saying the same, like repeating beats. And so I struggled a little bit with the repetitiveness of it. And ultimately, I found it not as threatening as I'd kind of wanted it to be, given the cast. It's a fair movie. It's a competent movie, and it's a good-looking movie. And I still struggled with it. What'd you think?
When it started, I was more dubious about where I felt it was going to be going. Like, I'm like, oh, I feel like I've seen this story a lot. This is a family member or somebody who covers up a dead body thinking that somebody they love killed this person, right? And I was like, oh, okay. So mom thinks her son, who's she recognizes as likely gay, even though he won't admit it yet. And they're both, I think, terrified of the fact that his dad might find out. This older, much older man who her son had been in a car accident with, drinking, and it created quite an issue for her son. It's a moment between mother and son that we have in flashbacks. And so she tells this older guy, stay away from my kid. And of course he doesn't. And then, he and the son fight. This man falls and ends up dead. But mom thinks the kid did it. The kid, I don't know if he ever thinks mom did it, but there's a lot of like mystery as to what actually he might think about all of this. But when the story started, I'm like, okay, so this is going to be mom makes a bad decision to hide a dead body. And then we're just going to spiral down from there. I was a little concerned about that. Then partway through the film, we end up in this situation where a person who had been in business, Alec Spira, who had been in business along with a man named Mr. Nagel, with Darby, the club owner that Bo was having a fling with, they are trying to blackmail mom to get $50,000 out because they have basically a sex tape. And they're going to release it. And so they're trying to, so that's kind of the story. They come into the story, but partway through the story, suddenly there is this moment where her father-in-law, he ends up having a heart attack and the blackmailer is over and ends up having to help her with CPR to save his life. And then from that point, I'm like, oh, okay, we're going to be getting a different story. That's kind of a relationship drama between the blackmailer and mom. And I was in it at that point. I found that story between Alec and Margaret a very compelling journey to see where were we going here. And his story, like Goran Visnjak.
He was Luka Kovac on ER. That's how I know it.
Well, and we talked about him very briefly on David Fincher's Girl with the Dragon Tattoo adaptation. I believe he worked at the paper, right?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Just, I don't know. I found his performance to be such a fascinating, more interesting version of a blackmailer than I'd seen. Like, I enjoyed where that story was going. And it, like, was there, like, a journey toward almost a love story. By the time she's, at the car that he had crashed at the end of the film, it felt like in another life, these two could have come together. And I guess in the book, maybe also in the previous adaptation, we'll talk about that at some point. It sounds like there was a little bit more of kind of this love story between the two of them. It doesn't quite go there, but it certainly makes Alec a more compelling character because he seems like somebody who's really starting to kind of, you know, see what's going on and kind of doubt where he is in his life. And so I found that interesting. I actually ended up enjoying it quite a bit.
So I see your point. I felt like by the end, so the end of the movie, they've concocted this escape and Al has killed Nagel in the boathouse and they concoct this plan to get away from the house and he takes off and then rolls the car, lost control of the car, and it ends up, it's going to be the perfect ending. She comes down, he says, make sure you take the tape and the money, and get away from here. They'll think he died in the accident, which is great. And then this is where I think Tilda Swinton overplays this part, because I don't think the relationship was sold enough to give her that kind of lost love. I just don't feel like we had enough setup that her relationship was enough kind of on the rocks with her husband to sell that she was that easily swayed by this guy. Like, there weren't enough beats that made him endearing besides, oh, I also can do CPR. Like, that was the one. Otherwise, he's just threatening and says, get the money over and over and over again. We know what you want. When you're here, we know that you're going to say get the money because we've heard it 1,000 times. And so I just felt like some of that relationship was a little empty to earn the final sort of tear-soaked goodbye as he dies in the car. And I will say that final shot as she reaches in and they don't kiss, but their faces kind of graze each other right at the lip. That is a beautiful shot. Gorgeous framing and blocking and everything. I just don't know that I was in the relationship at that point. It still felt kind of empty to me.
I can see that. I can definitely see that. But I guess for me, I just found her journey as this mother, because as I was watching this is one of these stories, like I said, it's like she makes this decision to cover up this body, this dead body that's lying by their beach house, because she thinks that her son did it. She thinks that after she confronted this guy, he came. And whatever happened between him and her son, it led to her son killing him. And that's kind of where her mind is with all of this. And so,
and we should say, because just as set up, the son didn't kill him. The son was confronted, they met in the boathouse and they had a fight, and Darby leaned on the railing and fell over onto the shore a few feet down, but happened to land on a boat anchor, which pierced his chest and he died.
After Bo had left.
So nobody killed him. He killed himself accidentally.
Yeah. But it, very much like everything is set up for both her and the son, where you could conceive, if the police, if they did report this, you could conceive that they did this. You can see why, okay, she came down and confronted him the day before, saying, stay away from my son. And we find out later that there is a sex tape of the two of them having sex, and neither the mother nor the son, even though he doesn't know about it, but neither of them really would want that to be released. And so there is plenty of reason where you could see, if you were the police investigating this, either of those people would have cause to kill this person.
Yes.
Like, it absolutely makes sense. So as I looked at all of this, I was like, okay, I can see why she goes to this length. And we do find out later when she's talking to Alec how the father, which we never see, he's in the military, he's off on a Navy vessel somewhere in the ocean and is very hard to get a hold of, isn't going to be back for a while. But she says he would never understand. Like, if finding out that our son is gay, it's not something that he'd be able to handle. So I thought about this, because I'm like, you know, just call the police. Why do we go through this? Just call the police. And, you know, the nature of this sort of story of a person making a dumb decision and then the rest of the film, they're dealing with the repercussions of that bad decision. Like, it fits in all the film noir films. It is definitely a thread that we've had in plenty of stories. Like, there is a place for this type of story. And so as I started this, I'm like, okay, so why is she making this? Can I buy into the fact that she's making this decision? As the film progressed, I'm like, okay, her son has the potential to get a great music scholarship somewhere. there is this struggle about his sexual identity in the family, particularly with dad. Like, there are a lot of reasons that I can see her making this decision and in a flash moment saying, okay, I have to take care of this. I mean, she just does it. It's not like something she thinks about long. It's like she just sees it and just like, crap, I got to deal with this, and does it. So I think that she's just kind of like in mom mode, largely, with a lot of this, to the point where even when she's confessing to Alex later in the film, I did it. You know, I killed him. I confronted him after my son talked to him, and I pushed him and killed him. I ended up really buying into that. And so when we do end up having that emotional connection between her and Alec, I think so much of that for me was in this very challenging place of very intense emotions that she's going through with all of this. He has found a connection through her. And again, I love that they don't actually push like a direction where the two of them fall in love or anything. Like, I didn't even think that until the end when she's leaning over him and it's like this almost kiss. Like, I felt like it was just this emotional connection just because they both ended up in this very intense emotional conflict. And so I guess for me, by the time we get to that point at the end, I bought into the fact that there was this, like, she could sense this emotional, like, I don't think necessarily like the tears, the connection and everything she was feeling so much was like, I am going to miss you. You could have been the love of my life. But I feel like that it's more this sense of emotional drain that she's having because, like, this is a person who was blackmailing her, ended up finding a connection because kind of just her humanity and just everything she's doing as a mom, and ends up kind of taking the rap for it. And I think so much of her, you know, the emotional beats that I felt through the end of the film is that, like, she is so guilty about everything that has happened and other people have kind of taken the fall for it and she can't say anything. It's just like this hidden guilt that she's going to be carrying, thinking that, you know, this other person went through this whole thing and died because she was trying to protect her son.
Okay. I can see that. I can see that. And I agree with you. I like that they didn't push the romance. Can we talk about Nagel? Because this gets into another issue that I struggle with, and I will open the floor for you to convince me otherwise.
Okay, Nagel is the more straightforward evil businessman in partnership with Alec.
Right, and Alec, like, works for him somehow. He also worked with Darby,
who owed them money.
Darby owed Nagel money, and Nagel wants his money, and he finds this tape, and decides to use this tape for blackmail over the family. One of the things that the movie sets up in a way that is impenetrable is that the family is not blackmailable to the degree that he wants them to be blackmailable because they don't have access to the cash. And I think that Tilda Swinton plays this, like, I can't get the money. I'm going to try to get the money. And she starts hawking things and they keep coming back with the same refrain all the way to the end where Nagel's here and doing it himself. If you want to do something right, vibe. And he shows up and he starts beating her up. The challenge that I have is that I'm so frustrated at that point. Not that he is such an immovable object that he's just so, you know, he's so evil and mean. Like Ray Barry sells it. He's a bad guy. Like he's a criminal, but that it feels like this is such a, like by the end, it's such kind of a non-story to me because I'm like, well, she doesn't have the money. She's demonstrated time and again. They've set up so many roadblocks to her getting enough cash that this can only end in a way that is wildly predictable. And so I struggled feeling anything in that final confrontation because I felt like the writers had made it so clear that that no one could bend, and no one bent, and eventually Barry was killed. Like there was no possibility, there was no threat that she could actually get the money somehow. There was nothing but running around to a pawn shop. And I felt like that it was just sort of a weak premise for the crime. And the fact that he didn't, like, he was so intractable that even after they tried to weave in this, oh, the killer has been arrested. It was obviously the wrong killer, but the killer's been arrested. And he's like, well, the tape is valueless. They try to sell that story. And his only retort to that is, oh, he's a clown. He'll be released in 24 hours. It's like by the third act, everything just gets kind of easy with regard to the crime.
Like, I thought that worked okay. Like, as far as like the potential fall guy having been arrested, that made the tape valueless, that they kind of knew would be released.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't have any issue with that. I thought that was actually an interesting element that we had there, that suddenly it's like Nagel still wanted the money. I can definitely see your point about Nagel being this intractable guy who just wants the money and will do anything he can to get it. That was like, well, you know, you hit a point where it's just not going to work. And, you know, what, you just take your losses, take what you can get and move on. It wasn't a huge issue for me, I guess. I, you know, by the time we got to the end of the story, I just kind of bought that in the story like this, Nagel is that evil businessman who wants the money. And if he doesn't get it, is just going to kill instead. And like, that's kind of where I was with the story. So I didn't have big issues, but I can definitely see your frustration with that element.
Well, and I think it's softened because of Al, right? Like Al, if you look at Al and Nagel as kind of the manifestation of evil, of kind of the duality of these malcontents, Al gets to be the side of that personality that gets to soften. And as a result of that, Nagel just gets to be hard, and hard to the point of being irrational at the end of the movie. There's no sense to him continuing to hit her to get more money because he's not getting himself any closer to getting the money.
Yeah.
And it becomes just sort of comical.
Well, it does make you wonder, like where is it going to go from here? Like, is he going to kidnap the children? Like, it, you know, how far is he going to take this to push to get the money? It's an interesting element. I can see the frustrations with it. I do think there is this level. I mean, you know, they're living in a fantastic house on the shores of Lake Tahoe. So you imagine that they do have money. Like, from Nagel's perspective, I can see that, okay, $50,000 is not that much to come up with for somebody living here. You know, like, there's an interesting element that I can see where he's coming from. And I think there is an element that the story does okay of him getting this impression that Alec has kind of fallen for Margaret. And Nagel thinks, like, you're useless to me. Like, you can't go falling for these people. I want the money. And so I think from Nagel's perspective, I can see why we end up kind of going the route that we do toward the end. So I don't know. I guess with all of that, I don't have as much of an issue with it.
Yeah. And like I said, I mean, I think overall it's a competent movie. I just felt like the part that I came for, right, the crime, I thought really was tricky for me to buy into. And it actually starts with the, you know, I actually really like the setup. I like the setup. I like the love or the secret romance. I like the fact that the kid's dealing with being able to be his kind of authentic self and come out. And it's, even though at this point it's a, you know, in 2001, I don't know, was it, you know, is this kind of, you know, this was sort of over scandalizing sexual identity at the time. We were still learning.
Well, it's always going to be a thing when you have a parent who is just not supportive. Like, I think that's the thing. It's like, it's never.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And making him the hardened captain in the Navy, right? That's like all of the stereotypes at play. But then he falls off the, and all credit to Josh Lucas for being able to pull the fall. And I mean, it's actually, I think in another movie, it would be just a really funny pratfall, like him falling through the thing and just disappearing from frame, I thought was really great. And then she sees him and then goes to, like, she doesn't notice him that night, right? Like that.
No.
Did I miss anything? She doesn't notice him until the next morning.
Correct. And she doesn't even recognize that it's him until she flips the body over.
Yeah, right. And that's when she makes the decision. As you already said, she goes into mom mode. But she takes him to the other side of the lake. And the whole time I'm shouting, drop him in the middle of the lake, weigh him down and drop him in the middle of the lake, because she drops him on the other side of the lake. It felt like in order to start a police investigation, right? Like there was, I just couldn't figure out, other than the writers needed to introduce conflict, why she didn't drop him in a place where he might not have been found quite so quickly. So I'm already kind of on team skeptical from 30 minutes into the movie. And so that made it, by the time we got to the end of the movie, it just made it hard for me to rationalize so many of these beats.
Well, and I guess, you know, in all of this, I could see the same thing. Like, why, you know, go to the middle where it's not going to be, where he's not visible from the surface, right? like looking
literally
up at you.
The water was so clear. You could see the expression on his face.
But I think my rationale with that is that I think from somebody who's hiding a body, I think the idea of being out in the middle of a lake where potentially you're more likely to be seen, as opposed to being in kind of this rocky alcove where you feel more hidden. Like, I think that's why it ended up playing more okay for me, is because it's just like she probably felt more exposed out in the middle where somebody could potentially see what she's doing.
What is your interpretation of time in this movie? What is the entire arc of movie time?
I mean, it felt like 3 days, 4 days.
Yeah.
It's very short.
To me too. Because it was, I mean, I feel like she hid the body and it was like either that night or early the next morning that they already had police cars all over it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, who knows? She did run home from where she dropped the car, and that could have taken 2 or 3 days. She could have Forrest Gumped it.
I don't think it was quite that far. But yeah, it is a very quick story, and the police are quick to act. You know, a fisherman snags the body, and of course, the investigation starts, and, you know, paranoia sets in, and, you know, every time a police car is driving by, she's freaking out. You know, it just, I don't know, all of that built, and it worked okay. What did you think of Tilda, though? Did you like her performance as mom?
I did not, actually. Weird, because I so love Tilda Swinton, but I felt like this, she was great as mom. I didn't feel like she was the mom to this family. Like, there was nothing about her relationship with anybody else in the family that felt like she wasn't more than a guest there, or that they had just met her. I never felt like she was attached to the family. And maybe that was intentional. Maybe that's how it was played, because she was having this distance strife with her captain husband. I don't know, but it felt like she was not in a way that she was struggling with her family members, but literally like she didn't know them.
I guess I didn't read it that way, but I definitely felt like this is a colder mother. Like, the way that she talks with the kids, that plans with the kids, even her father-in-law, everything felt a little more rigid. Like, the first time we meet her, when she goes and talks to Darby at the club and then comes home, she's wearing like this very rigid suit. Like, she just feels like they chose to make her somebody who felt very icy and stiff, and even with her family, like, had a hard time interacting and just having straight up conversations. It was all very kind of dictatorial, just the way that she ran things, you know. And I think some of that was just her relationship with them, and some of it was the way that she behaved, and yeah, some of it was whatever was going on between her and her husband. There definitely seemed like there might be some angle there. And, you know, I think, I don't know, I enjoyed Tilda a lot. It's funny because it's an easy film to compare with We Need to Talk About Kevin, another film about a mom dealing with actions caused by a son. And, you know, that's definitely my preference of the two films. That film is just incredible. But I do think that she's delivering an interesting performance here, and I enjoyed her.
The thing is, this is also the spiritual prequel to Tar. Like, really, why she's so cold is because actually inside she's a world famous conductor who's very hard on the world.
Well, she clearly can, when her son like wrote that music, she's looking at it. And I was like, oh, so can she read sheet music? Because she was sure looking like she could. So maybe.
Yep. Like a poem, she could read that music.
Yeah. What did you think of Goran Wisniewski? Did you like his performance?
Yeah, I like him. He's, you know, he's handsome. I like his accent. Like, he's just sort of, a funny guy. And I feel like I know him really well because I watched him for so many years on ER, and that it's, he's one of those that I can see why it might be tricky to start casting him in other things, because I think he's really well known in that character. I think they did for casting a criminal who has a heart of gold. I think they got the right guy, right? Like, I believe that he, you know, that he was a guy who's a criminal, but struggles not with finding vulnerability in his soft side, but struggles with actually exuding authority. Like, he just, I think he's able to balance those things really well.
You know, I never watched ER, so I didn't really have that sense of him. He, for me, largely ends up being one of those, that guys who pops up in things, and I always enjoy him. I'm always like, God, he's such an interesting presence on screen. Like, I find him kind of captivating to watch. So as this person who came into her life right out of the gate, I'm like, okay, there's something interesting with what he's bringing here. I enjoyed him quite a bit.
Yeah, very much.
Jonathan Tucker is the son, Beau. He is somebody that I've seen in a lot of films as a young man. Like, we talked about him back in The Virgin Suicides. He was in The Ruins, which I really love. And he was also in Hostage, another film that is absolutely worth checking out with Bruce Willis. Somebody who's been in things, but it doesn't seem to be overly celebrated as an actor. But I find that generally I'm enjoying him when I do see him. What do you think of him as Bo?
I think he was great as Bo. I mean, I think it was a role that demands more early on of him to play this sort of uncertainty, identity uncertainty, and sort of his relationship with Josh. And I think that's an interesting play. I think he was charismatic to watch, and it's hard. He was also in I Can't Believe You Didn't Mention The Ruins from 2008. I did mention The Ruins. You did? You said that out loud? I was sitting here staring at it, waiting for you to say it.
Yeah, I said I loved it.
Whispering Flowers. And that's kind of what his nickname is to me, is Whispering Flower.
Yeah, you're right, though. He has more to do earlier in the film. Like, once it becomes Mom's story, like, there are moments between him and Mom discussing things, kind of like talking about stuff, but largely it becomes a story that's her story, and he is just kind of the kid who's just going on with music class now. Like, I don't know if I necessarily wanted more from him, but I would say that by the time we get to that final moment between him and Mom, I like that really worked for me. Like, the way that he was able to kind of comfort her and just like everything, like, he, I don't think knows what's going on. I think, if anything, he thought perhaps there might have been some form of an affair or something. Like, we don't really know, but I don't think we ever think he killed Darby. I think she thinks he killed Darby and went through this whole thing, but I don't think he thinks the opposite.
Just in terms of armchairing, right? What is your sense of how the movie would have played had there been a more clear reconciliation between the two?
You know, I don't know if it really would have changed much about the movie other than kind of the relationship between mother and son, as far as like more of an acknowledgement and a long term guilt through his life that he thinks that his mother did this for him, you know?
This is one of the things that I thought was curious, and I don't necessarily know that I feel strongly one way or the other. I don't mind the uncertainty at the end, right? The uncertainty about their relationship. But they did set up at the beginning that this was a relationship where they really struggled to talk to one another about important subjects, right? That they don't know how to have those hard conversations. And one of the opportunities that they had in writing the script is that potentially by the end, to give us a dose of acknowledgement that maybe that was the thing that needed to change between them, that maybe going through this ordeal was actually a way to open a door to talk about hard things between mother and son. And we didn't get that, right? Instead, we got status quo, which possibly says its own message, right? Which is that, you know, it's going to be impossible for these people to talk about hard things. They showed that they couldn't talk about hard things at the beginning of the movie, and they still can't talk about hard things. But I did wonder at the end, what would it have been like had they been able to have some sort of a reckoning that outlines the miscommunication along the way that led to how they acted for one another.
I didn't see it as a problem. The problem for me isn't that they can't talk about things. I mean, they can't. That's definitely there. But for me, it felt
it's
like
just
the problem,
not a problem.
Well, no, the problem is just that they're unable to connect, or she's trying to, but he keeps this wall up and won't connect with her. And I felt that by the time we got to the end, they were past that and he was comforting his mother. Like, I felt like we didn't necessarily need the talk, the fact that there was comfort there and there was an opportunity for a connection, for me, was what worked. I don't know if a conversation would have played well.
Yeah, I don't either.
I like the fact that it's just this hug during this overwhelming grief. And I don't know, I just think like just this feeling of this tragedy that she's got kind of in her life that she'll never be able to voice. Like, that was such a, that's the thing that is so painful, is like this hidden thing that she'll have to hide forever. And it's just, I don't know, a really interesting character element for her.
Josh Lucas, we don't get much of Josh Lucas. He's, we get the feeling that he's a dirtbag very early. He plays it well. And then we get a couple of quick confrontations and then he's out of the movie. I really like Josh Lucas, and I think he does exactly what the part demanded of him.
Yeah.
I could not help but wonder at one point, what if they had switched casting between Goran Wisniewski and Josh Lucas? Like, what if Josh Lucas had been the guy who stuck around, the criminal, you know, demanding for money, and Goran was the club owner and having an affair with the son?
I mean, I could see it playing that way.
Yeah.
There's something with Josh Lucas that I'm trying to think, have I seen him play something with that has a little bit more of the compassion that you get in Alex's character? It's entirely possible I have. I just can't think of it off the top of my head. But I genuinely like him. I like him in bigger parts. I think small parts like this, I think he does a great job at giving it a really interesting angle. And like, I just enjoyed him a lot in this. He just plays that well, you know?
Yeah, I do too. I think he plays exactly what he needed to play in this movie. I think he brings such a hard edge to him that I really enjoy watching this guy on screen.
Yeah, absolutely. The directors, Scott McGeehee and David Siegel, are a directing duo. This is their eighth film that they have done together, starting in 93 with a film called Suture. And then this, and then B Season, Uncertainty, What Maisie Knew, and then Montana Story was their most recent one in 2021. They got quite a bit of buzz. That was Haley Lou Richardson and Owen Teague as two siblings coming back to their ranch after, I think, their family members or their parent had died or something, and they have to come back and deal with everything. It got a lot of positive buzz when that came out. And I didn't see it, though. This is the only film of theirs that I've seen, you know, and I think it's interesting. And in the scope of actually putting the story together, Scott McGeehee, it's based on a book by called The Blank Wall by Elizabeth Sanksay Holding. It was adapted by Max Ophuls in the 40s, called The Reckless Moment, with James Mason and Joan Bennett as our two leads. And it's essentially the same story, but it's I think what Scott McGeehee and David Siegel brought to their adaptation was shifting the characters to have the angle of the homosexual element that you didn't get in the original. It was just an angle that they wanted to approach with the story and do something a little different from the original book, but a lot of the elements are the same when you look at kind of the previous film and the book. It seems like the synopsis is pretty straightforward. As far as what they're bringing to the table with the writing and the direction, do you have any, did anything stand out for you? Any thoughts in what they're doing with the direction?
Well, I mean, I think talking about the cinematography, the, working in concert with the direction, right? I just feel like they created a film that looks good. I like the pacing of it. It's for a movie about murder and hiding a body. It's kind of a quiet movie, propelled in large part by the stoicism of Tilda Swinton. I think that was, I mean, that's, it's a vibe that they architected by choice, and that feels, it feels intentional. And, I think the conflict between the piece of the look of the film, the way it handles darkness and sunrises and sunsets and the water is beautiful. So, you know, all credit to them for creating that kind of discontinuity between the subject matter and the environment. I think it works.
Yeah. I think that there were some interesting elements throughout the film that the way that they chose to frame things and hold on things, and like some interesting moments where we were pulling back, like from the house particularly, like where you'd get a drifting shot out of, you know, we would see mom through the window and the camera would be kind of floating back, and then we'd get really wide and we just sit almost this sense of like how isolated they are and how perhaps also how alone she feels in all of this, you know. And I think there was some interesting element there even from the beginning of the film. And, you know, playing with sound, pairing with the image was kind of an interesting thing that I noticed. Like the start of the film, we're hearing the buzz, buzz, buzz of her as she's buzzing the door to be let into this this nightclub after hours so that she can go talk to Darby. And so that kind of starts the film off. And even then, once we open the film, we see a wide shot of her standing against this wall with this silver door. And so she's very, I don't know, they do a great job of kind of isolating her and putting her into spaces where she's the only thing in a fairly big space. And then by the time we get to the end of the film, again, the camera's drifting away from the house and we hear the ring, ring, ring of the phone. And then her daughter saying the dad's on the phone. And so there's just an interesting way to kind of create the space and everything. And a lot of blue. They really were using the blue to kind of create like this cool, icy feel to the film throughout. Like as soon as she goes into the nightclub at the very beginning, the lighting is all blue. And, you know, we have that a number of times. And it's interesting the way that they kept that icy feel through the film, even with her outfits. And then it was such an interesting shift when suddenly she's in this bright red dress coat, you know. It's just like that was a big shift for that last act of the film when she's going out in that red coat.
You mentioned the beginning, and I thought this was actually kind of a neat trick where, you know, it starts with a confrontation in the nightclub and then we cut back to the serenity of her house on Tahoe. And I thought it was a flashback. I thought that was a framing device, that in fact we were going to, that was actually the end of the movie, was the confrontation with Josh Lucas, because why would you kill Josh Lucas so early in the movie? and I was surprised when, you know, she goes into the room with Bo and sits down and says, I saw Darby today. I know he called, right? Like that was, I thought that was a really neat trick, and it kind of put me on my back foot for the movie. Like, I don't know what I'm going to expect. That's a good feeling.
Yeah, right. I liked the structure. I liked the way that they put it together. You know, we do get those little flashbacks throughout as she's remembering the car accident that her son was in and dealing with her feelings about that and where that's put the relationship between her and her son, as far as all the additional strain dealing with that, dealing with the fact that he was underage, being allowed to drink at this gay nightclub, and, you know, sleeping with the guy who runs the place. Like there's this whole element that she's trying to sort out as a parent, and just like, I don't know, the way that they captured it through images throughout, I thought was pretty solid.
Yeah, me too, for sure.
Oh, we didn't talk about the cinematographer. Giles Nutjens is the cinematographer for this film. And this was, you know, we're talking about the Sundance Independent Spirit Awards, definitely earlier in, or more of a lower budget type of project. But that being said, Giles has been around for a long time, born in 1960. Lot of work through the 90s on things. And then I think, I'm trying to look and see like where... a lot of Adventures of the Young Indiana Jones shows, Battlefield Earth, a cinematographer on that right before this, an interesting one. And then a lot of, it looks like has continued working with these, this directing pair through a number of their films through. It might be through all of their films, because even up through Montana's Story, pretty recent. But then stuff like Enola Holmes and Enola Holmes 2 and Hell or High Water. I think a cinematographer who
was great.
Yeah. Capturing some beautiful, beautiful images.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, that's funny. Lots of water, right? Swim fan, filming underwater and in that kind of thing. And I, you know, I know we dropped some of these titles, but I really liked Bee Season. I thought that was great. What Maisie Knew was great.
Oh, so you did see some of the films from these directors. Yeah.
But I wasn't tracking who they were at the time until I just saw them right now. I thought, oh, wow, they actually have a good, they're just very different. The thing that's interesting about those two is that they're so focused on this central child relationship and the family dynamic as it revolves around a child. And what's interesting when you come to this film, it's kind of the same thing. The child is significantly older, but it's still the breaking and rehabilitation of a relationship between a mother and son, and how these parents can navigate their relationship. And in this movie, it's interesting because one of the parents is AWOL, and how do you navigate a relationship solo? But I think thematically, they sort of are of a piece, which is, I think, interesting.
Well, that's definitely an interesting thread through The Deep End, Bee Season, What Maisie Knew, even Montana Story. All of those films are stories that deal with relationships between children and their parents, or their children dealing with their parents, or their parents dealing with their children, thinking about their children. Like that is definitely a thread that these writer-directors seem to really focus on in their storytelling interests.
Yeah, they're working through some stuff, is what I'm hearing. They definitely are working through some stuff.
The new film that they have coming out is called The Friend, follows a story of love, friendship, grief, and healing about a writer who adopts a Great Dane that belonged to a late friend and mentor. Bill Murray, Naomi Watts, Carla Gugino, Constance Wu, Owen Teague again, Ann Dowd. Yeah, should be an interesting one.
A dog movie, Andy.
I know.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if I can do it.
Yeah. So, well, you know, I definitely think it's an interesting one. If anything, I know I connected with this film more than you did, but I don't know. And you've seen more of their films, but it certainly makes me want to actually go watch some of these films of theirs. Like I haven't seen the other ones, and now I'm really curious to see how the rest of these feel, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think for me, they feel better. But again, like I come off as the harbinger of hate here for this movie, and I'm really not. I just felt like the things I was looking for in this movie, I didn't get. And maybe on a second viewing, I would appreciate it more. And it's a fine movie. It doesn't steal a bunch of stars from any other film yet, though.
Okay. Gotcha. All right. Well, I guess that's it for this. So we'll be right back. But first, our credits.
The Next Reel is a production of True Story FM, engineering by Andy Nelson, music by Vyacheslav Draganov, Oriol Novella, and Eli Catlin. Andy usually finds all the stats for the awards and numbers at the-numbers.com, boxofficemojo.com, imdb.com, and wikipedia.org. Find the show at truestory.fm, and if your podcast app allows ratings and reviews, please consider doing that for our show. Andy, can you believe we've almost hit 700 episodes of The Next Reel?
I know, it's crazy. And with all the other episodes in our family of podcasts, we are well over 1,200 episodes of movie conversation. It's really pretty amazing that we've gotten to have these in-depth movie chats every week for over a decade now.
And we couldn't have done it without our loyal community of film fans. Their support over the years has meant so much.
For sure. That reminds me, we should give the merch store a shout out. Buying shirts from thenextreel.com/merch is a great way listeners can continue to support the show. Plus, they get to sport our great designs.
Absolutely. I think sometimes folks forget we have a variety of shirts, mugs, phone cases, and more available. In fact, a great place to start is with a shirt sporting the Next Reels logo.
We also have that classic Fast Times Spicoli Surf School tee, or the weirdly popular Rusty's European Tour shirt.
The one from National Lampoon's European Vacation. Why is that so popular?
Search me, but we have sold a ridiculous number of those. I guess there are a lot of Rusty's taking trips to Europe?
We're always adding new designs based on movies we've covered, like our brand new design for A Streetcar Named Desire, featuring a streetcar named Desire. So if you want to rep your love of TNR and films, head to thenextreel.com/merch.
Every purchase helps us continue to have these weekly in-depth conversations. So visit thenextreel.com/merch today.
And as always, thanks for listening and being a part of the Next Reel community. We've got lots more great movie chats coming your way. All right. I feel like we already kind of teased some of this. Does this movie make you want to go back and read The Blank Wall?
You know, I'm very curious about it now. It was Elizabeth Sangsay Holding wrote it in 1947. Largely the same, except it wasn't a gay love story. It was, you know, this young girl instead of Beau, it was Bee, and she was she kind of fell for this guy, and the husband was off at World War II. So, like, you can see how it's translatable. Like, I can see where all of that came from. It did get translated, like I said, in 1949. Max Ophuls directed the film The Reckless Moment, which is kind of a noirish adaptation of it. Largely sounds the same. But I am interested in checking it out. I'll have to see. But that's it. I haven't seen any other notes about other adaptations or other people looking to adapt it.
Wow. James Mason,
Joan Bennett.
Yeah, looks like an interesting one. How'd it do at the award season?
Well, that's why we're here. It did okay. It had 4 wins with 19 other nominations. It premiered at Sundance, and it did win for Best Cinematography in a Dramatic Film. It was also nominated for the Grand Jury Prize for Dramatic Films, same category where The American Astronaut was last week, but lost to The Believer. Memento also lost there. Hedwig and the Angry Inch lost there. And I haven't seen The Believer. I can't speak to its strengths, but I just remember hearing that it was an impressive film. Ryan Gosling was great in it. Have you seen that one?
That was the
neo-Nazi one.
That was the Phoenix, right? Wasn't yeah, I haven't seen it. That was the
summer
Nazi
Phoenix
one.
Yeah, Summer Phoenix. Yeah. So anyway, that won, but Donnie Darko lost, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, In the Bedroom, Memento, American Astronaut, The Deep End. Like, a lot of, there were 16 films up for the award, and The Believer is the one that won.
Wow.
Interesting list of films. Over at the Golden Globes, this is probably where I heard of the film. Tilda Swinton was nominated for Best Actress in a Drama, but lost to Sissy Spacek in The Bedroom. And here at the Film Independent Spirit Awards, Swinton was nominated for Best Female Lead, but again, lost to Sissy Spacek. And the film was nominated for Best Cinematography, but lost to Mulholland Drive. Last week, I said Memento won. I was incorrect in that. It's Mulholland Drive. It'll be the last film that we talk about in this series. That is the film that won Best Cinematography.
But at the box office, this film blew the doors off, right? Won all the money.
Won all the money. McGeehee and Siegel had a budget of $3 million for their independent film, which is almost $5.4 million in today's dollars. The movie premiered at Sundance, as I said, January 2001, and then released August 8th, 2001 by Fox Searchlight, opposite American Pie 2, The Others, Osmosis Jones, and the limited release of Session 9. The movie expanded eventually to 412 screens and went on to earn $8.8 million domestically and $1.2 million internationally for total gross of $17.9 million in today's dollars. All told, it's a small success for an indie film, landing with an adjusted profit per finished minute of almost $125,000.
Okay, that's something. It's made some money.
It's made some money. It's a film that, it's an independent film. It definitely feels kind of low budget, indie. It's an interesting story. You know, I think it connects for some people. I can see why it's not a film that's talked about a whole lot these days, but I don't know. I still found it an engrossing watch. I'm glad we talked about it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad we talked about it too. How's that? Look, silver lining.
I guess that counts for a win.
Yeah, that's a win.
All right. Well, we'll be back for our ratings, but first, here's the trailer for next week's movie, John Cameron Mitchell's Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
Ladies and gentlemen, whether you like it or not.
Ow!
Hedwig! Don't you know me, Kansas City? I'm the new Berlin Wall. Try and tear me down.
How did some slip of a girly boy become the internationally ignored song stylist barely standing before you?
Damn, handsome. I can't believe you're not a girl.
Looks like we got some sugar daddies in the house. You could give me a cavity, honey.
Now you're interested, huh?
Inch, yeah. Not itch.
Intrigued. It is clear that I must find my other half. But is it a he or a she? Can two people actually become one?
The dark turns and noise of this wicked little town.
One day, in the late mid-80s, I was in my early late 20s.
I never knew that woman before that night, and I never knew she wasn't a woman.
I've got a sweet tooth. Songs exploded out of us. We were outgrossing monster trucks in Wichita.
When it comes to huge openings, a lot of people think of me.
Yes, you've got some sugar.
I had tried singing once, and they threw tomatoes. So after the show, I had a nice salad.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, both of you.
Did you put a bra in a dryer?
Yes.
How many times do I have to tell you? You don't put a bra in a dryer. It warps.
Okay, everybody.
I put on some makeup. Suddenly I'm this punk rock star.
Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
When I think about all the people I have come upon in my travels, I have to think about the people who have come upon me.
It is hard to believe we've been having in-depth weekly conversations about movies since 2011.
You're telling me producing this show week after week is so much fun, but it does require a lot of work behind the scenes. If you'd like to help support our efforts, one easy way is by using our Originals page when shopping for books and movies that we've covered.
Your purchases made through our links give us a small commission at no extra cost to you and allow us to keep having these great discussions.
The Originals page at thenextreel.com/originals links to the source material for all of our adapted film discussions. Purchasing through our links supports the show.
In season 13, we explore various awards categories and the films nominated in them.
We wrapped up our 1940 Best Picture series with adaptations of Mice and Men from John Steinbeck and Wuthering Heights from Emily Bronte's novel, not to mention the play Dark Victory by George Brewer Jr. and Bertram Block.
The 1947 Academy Award adapted screenplay series featured Anna and the King of Siam, based on Margaret Langdon's book, plus The Best Years of Our Lives, Brief Encounter, and The Killers.
The 1952 cinematography nominees included Death of a Salesman and A Streetcar Named Desire, A Place in the Sun, based on both a play and a book, and Strangers on a Train, based on Patricia Highsmith's first novel.
So many great movies based on books and plays, like Beckett, The Pumpkin Eater,
A Boy and His Dog, Rollerball,
The Princess Bride, Congo, The Scarlet Letter,
Jackie Brown, The Deep End, The Gray, The Woman in Black,
and Top Gun Maverick, which I'm very much looking forward to revisiting.
Get the source books at thenextreel.com/originals.
Start your next read or reread from the movies we've covered. Visit thenextreel.com/originals today. Letterboxd, Andy. Letterboxd, you know, it's where we rate all our movies and collect all our stars. What are you going to do for this movie? 5 stars, Beating Heart.
I enjoyed this film. I found it to be an interesting watch. I enjoyed the characters. I enjoyed the drama of it. That being said, it's not like a film that I walked out loving or anything, but I do find like I connected with it. So I think I'm going to just say 3 stars and a heart is where I'm going to sit with this one.
Well, what am I going to do now? What am I going to do now? That is heart. I don't know what to do now because that is a middle of the road movie for me. And therefore, middle of the road deserves 3 stars. But I like the movie less than you. So how is that possible? Stars don't make sense anymore.
The struggle with no half stars, Pete. You could do 2.5, but
no, alas. I have to do 2. I have to do 2, but I will give it a heart.
You don't have to do two. You can still do three.
You have made it. This is on you. You you bear the responsibility of these two stars.
Wow. Okay, so two stars from Pete.
Two stars and a heart.
But two stars and a heart. Okay, so yeah. that leaves us with an average rating of 2.5 over on Letterboxd. You can find us there at The Next Reel. You can find me at Soda Creek Film, and you can find Pete at Pete Wright. So what did you think about The Deep End? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Hop into the Show Talk channel over in our Discord community where we will be talking about the movie this week.
When the movie ends,
our conversation begins.
Letterboxd here with Andrew.
As Letterboxd always doeth.
You want to start? Why don't you start?
I'll start. I've got a very short and easy one by Degel. 4 stars and a heart. Stay-at-home moms really do it all.
Okay. Good. That's good. I have one that's a little bit longer and a little bit... it's serious, but it brings up some points that we echoed and some that we didn't. So I'm going to read a selection of a 2.5-star review from Wraithape. A more modern adaptation of The Blank Wall that suffers less from the melodramatic excesses of Max Ophuls, The Reckless Moment, but it has its own issues with plausibility as the film plunges into an overwrought final act. I prefer the Ophuls version by a slim margin, but if I'm honest, I'll normally plump for classic film noir over the neo variety. Anyway, despite the source material, I would really call this a neo-noir. It's not highly stylized. The cinematography and understated acoustic score by Peter Naschel put it more towards realism, but the ever-increasing plot contrivances and improbable decision-making work against that. Let me ask you something. If you had a motorboat and access to a large lake, whereabouts would you choose to dump a body? Probably near the shore, right? In shallow water where it's easily detectable by investigating cops. On the flip side, it does set up an innovative key retrieval scene. And goes on, but finally the verdict is, it never seems sure whether it wants to be a drama or a thriller and ends up not quite being either. Mm. So we just spent an hour for me to try and say that.
Indeed. I do want to point out, I didn't know this, but I did see it in another review that, so I just Googled this to check. Lake Tahoe is one of the clearest bodies of water in the world due to its significant depth, low watershed rate, and granite composition. And so you could see a solid white disc the size of a dinner plate lowered into the water until it is invisible to the naked eye. The clarity rating, according to the Secchi depth test, they first did the test in 1968, over 100 feet you could still see it.
So doesn't it make sense that you would want to drop a body below 100 feet in maybe the deepest part of the lake, in the lake that is the clearest in the goddamn universe? saying, man,
she has things to learn. She clearly has things to learn.
Thanks, Letterboxd. I've been podcasting since 2006. In that time, I've tried countless hosting platforms. But in August 2022, we switched to Transistor to power all of our shows here at True Story FM. And it's been a game changer.
I love the Transistor allows unlimited podcasts and storage without extra charges. We can publish so much content, and we do. If you want to start up a podcast, do yourself a favor and host your show on Transistor.
With their one-click publishing, you can get your new show onto all the major podcast directories effortlessly.
And their website builder lets you quickly build custom sites for each show.
The detailed analytics are invaluable, too. You can access all kinds of listener data anytime.
Oh, and the versatile players allow you to embed episodes anywhere to reach new listeners. Plus, the team behind Transistor is super responsive and keeps making the platform even better.
After using countless hosting services over 15-plus years, Transistor has been, hands down, the best podcast partner for us.
If you want a hosting platform to take all the worry out of getting your podcast out into the world, go to thenextreel.com/transistor and check it out.
Support our show and support your own show by going to thenextreel.com/transistor
Start growing your podcast today.